Bruchim Aboyim to the fourth of the series of lectures on the book of Rabbi Yoshebeir Soloveitchik Zatzal, The Emergence of Ethical Man. And last, we're going to continue where we left off last week, namely, in the first part of the book, which is in fact, the first chapter begins on page 3, man as an organic being. And we're going to continue and speak about what Rabbi Soloveitchik says is man as a plant. Now, there are very, very important ideas that Rabbi Soloveitchik expresses in this first chapter. In other words, man as a plant, before chapter 2 on page 31, where man is a carnivorous being. The overall scheme of his thought is that in fact the days of creation, which speak about a development to higher life forms, more or less, represent in fact actually different levels in man himself. In other words, man is in fact an aggregation of the different stages of creation. He's a evolutionary being in that sense, whether we mean it biologically or conceptually. In other words, in the scientific sense or the Briska sense. But in any case, there's an aspect of man which is a plant. Now, Rabbi Soloveitchik, in fact, brings several psukim, several verses from the Chumash, in which we clearly make what he calls analogy between man and a plant. For example, he brings the famous pasuk in Devarim, right? That Adam is Eitz HaSadeh, the tree of the field is like a man. And then he notes the fact that the commandment, for example, of Pirei Rivya, of reproduction, right, in the Chumash, is first expressed to plants, then to animals, then to man, in exactly the same language. So in other words, clearly, and also too, he brings from the prophets, the Vim, which compare man to a plant, clearly, man, there's a plant aspect, a plant dimension to man. Now, in addition to this immanental analogy, Rabbi Soloveitchik, of course, draws halachic conclusions for this. In other words, in what sense is, in fact, man as a plant expressed in the halacha? So, as far as this is concerned, Rabbi Soloveitchik understands that the plant aspect of man, the plant aspect of man, relates to states of man's biological existence, which he associates with what we call involuntary biological functions. For example, he says on page 16, right, concerning his entire physiological biological functional system, breathing, assimilation of organic matter, circulation of the blood, glandular secretion, and so on, man does not differ from the plant, right? I think that's called involuntary biological functions. The same automatic non-teleoskeneic or non-self-conscious functionalism which operates within man and regulates his response to the outside prevails in plant. In this regard, man is not to be found one degree above the physiological operation of the plant. In other words, there's an aspect of man's biological being which is that of a plant. Okay? He says, we are not cognizant of the functions of our body, and there's no possibility that man will ever become directly conscious of that physiological performance. Now, the fact is that having realized that not only scripturally is man compared to a plant, but there actually are there's a physiological dimension of man which is actually plant-like. So, there, after that, later on, Rabbi Soloveitchik speaks about the function of a plant, or the understanding of the existence of a plant. And there, he speaks about the two important characteristics that are pertinent to our problem. This is on page 15. There's a within-without parallelism. And there he quotes Murphy, who actually wrote a book on psychology, but somehow he was actually a famous parapsychologist, but actually spoke about plants, who says the organism exists because outer changes and inner adjustments are nicely attuned. In other words, there is an inner essence existence which behaves towards the outside in a certain fashion. The structured entity must maintain contact with its environment, otherwise it will die. The crystal has absolutely no relationship with the world outside. It is either completely encapsulated or, on the contrary, forms part of the environment. The plant is, on the other hand, bounded as an internal structure. On the other hand, it cannot be isolated from the environment. It has an inner existence, which depends upon an outer world. And then he says, after that, number two, notwithstanding the first characteristic of existence within, the plant functionally and more phenomenologically flows together with its environment. The world and the inner structure form one self-non-self. So the plant exists in and of itself, but has somehow this osmotic effect with its environment. Now, what are the parallels in the halacha? So it's here that Rabbi Soloveitchik, in fact, draws two parallels in the halacha. Right? The first parallel to halacha he draws is actually a fetus. A fetus, right, biologically is very similar to this description of a plant. And the second analogy he draws is to what's called a what the Shulchan Aruch calls a goises, which means an individual on the brink of death. So he says here on page 27, let us first consider the laws pertaining to the endpoints of life, the embryo and the goises. Okay? It's interesting. Man begins as a plant and ends as a plant. He begins as a fetus, which is plant-like, and ends as a goises, which is also plant-like. So he says, turning to the beginning of life, I'm reading from page 28, even the embryo in the womb is considered under many aspects a person endowed with juridic prerogatives. The murder of an unborn child is classified as a crime, which is punishable with misa bidei shamayim. Indeed, even a non-Jew is executed for killing fetuses. Whenever the life of the unborn child is endangered, the law of pikuach nefesh is applicable according to the opinion of many rishonim. Even in the case of an abnormal death, when the physician is allowed to sacrifice the unborn baby for the well-being of the mother, Maimonides introduces the motive of roidev. The physician is instructed to save the mother because the child is classified as a roidev. Otherwise, it would be prohibited to prefer the life of the mother to his. So in other words, basically, the fetus is like an individual. And even if the mother's life is in danger, right, and is permitted to kill the fetus, but why? Not because he's not considered to be a viable human being or an individual, but rather because it's considered to be a goyit, a pursuer. This is what Soloveitchik says. And then he goes on to the case of a goyit, a person in the state of coma, who's also sort of like in a, what you usually call a vegetative state. And there, of course, killing a goyit also is an act of murder, and that's what Soloveitchik understands. Now, it's very interesting, he picked these two examples. In the case of a goyit, Rabbi Yoshaber, I'm calling him now Rabbi Yoshaber, is very, very much drawing upon the Torah of his grandfather, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. The famous question, which is asked in the Rambam, in Hilchos Ritzayach, right, is, in fact, the Rambam says, in Perak Aleph Alachatez, he's speaking about the mitzvah of roideh for the pesuah. So he says, "Af mitzvah loisah say shloim lachus al nefesh haroideh. One should not take mercy on the nefesh, on the life of a roideh for pesuah. The fichach hayru chachamish ubra sheim makshe leled muta lachtecha uba b'meir. That a woman who's actually having difficulty in giving birth, and I guess she's in danger, one can actually perform an abortion. One can actually kill the uba, kill the fetus." Because he's like a roidev, he's pursuing her lahoga to kill her. Now, I don't want to go into an entire shiur on the sugya of this sugya, which appears in the Gemara Sanhedrin. But the interesting is that the question asked by all the Rishonim, right, all the Achronim, is in fact from the Gemara Sanhedrin. It appears that the child is only a roidev, when in fact actually he comes. In other words, you know, he's born. He comes out of the mother's womb. But inside the mother, right, it would appear, at least from a you know, for a first reading of the Gemara, the reason you can kill the Uba because it's not considered a form of life. Right? However, Rab Chaim, in Chiddush Rab Chaim, and Hilchos Tzeiach Shmiras HaNefesh, in fact, actually introduces the concept that no, that the Uber, the fetus, is called a Nefesh. It's called a Nefesh. Now, he's called a Nefesh with different dinim than that of the mother, and that's why even when he's in the mother's womb, right, we give prerogative to the, in other words, we give somehow prerogative to the mother, as opposed to when he leaves the mother's womb, we don't give prerogative to the mother. But nonetheless, Reb Chaim defines the child as, in fact, actually being a Raidev. And many of the shuvas of the Paiskim, who are very, very much opposed to abortion, among them the Ikus Meshach of Moshe Feinstein, that in fact actually considered a person who actually aborts a baby to be a Ritzeach, to be a murderer, and Moshe Feinstein, in fact, draws, actually quotes, this Reb Chaim is one of his sources that Ritzicha applies to a fetus, even though the mother's life is not in danger, because we see clearly that the Rambam had to give the reason of Roidev in order to justify the killing of the fetus when the mother's life is in danger, because he's called a Nefesh. Now, needless to say, this interpretation of the Rambam is not agreed upon by everybody. I might, of course, add my 2 cents, is that if you look in the Rambam in the Meir Nevuchim, in Perek Mem, in Chelek Gimel, chapter 40 in the third Chelek, the Rambam understands Roidev to be much different. In fact, according to the Rambam, it appears to be that the Rambam understands that the killing of a Roidev is not because we're worried that the life is in danger, but rather the killing of the Roidev is to prevent a person from doing a crime. In which case, we'd have to say that when the Rambam says that the Uber is a Roidev, he doesn't mean literally it's a Roidev. And even though you think I'm reading into the Rambam, actually that's the Lashon of the Rambam. The Rambam says he's kir roidev. He's like a roidev. But he's not really a roidev. But I'm not giving a shir to make hasogas a Reb Chaim al Rambam. But in any case, what's interesting is in the Rambam is that Rabbi Soloveitchik brings from Hilchos Balachim that in fact a person who kills a Rabbi Soloveitchik says if a person kills an unborn child, he says, even a non-Jew is executed for killing fetuses. In fact, nowhere, in fact, even though the Rambam does paskin in Hilchas Balachim, that if a guy does kill an Uba, he's chayav misa b'dei shamayim, there's no indication in the Rambam that the same din applies to a Jew too. But not to go into this, but in other words, Rabbi Yosha ben Soloveitchik is very, very much drawing upon the Torah of Reb Chaim, that an Uber is considered, in fact, actually to be a form of life. In which case, if that's true, then our Soloveitchik explains the din of an Uber. Because we don't normally look at an Uber as being a form of life, unless you're a fundamentalist Christian, right, or Catholic. That in fact, man has this plant-like aspect to him, and an Uber represents man as a plant. And we have to look at an aspect of man as a plant, and because of this, killing an Uber is in fact killing man as a plant, and therefore, because of this, it's mashma that he says that he's chay of death at the hands of heaven. Now, in the case of the guy, he says, Rabbi Soloveitchik, in fact, actually makes the same claim. We say it's an act of murder, of killing a guy, says, even though this person is in fact actually in a possible vegetative state. Nonetheless, for the same reason that we understand that the notion of man as being a plant not only is something which is expressed in the psukim, in the verses of the Torah, but in fact actually has important halachic consequences. Okay, so that's a very, very important thing. We see clearly here that Rabbi Soloveitchik's understanding of man's immanence in the natural world, in fact, is a philosophy of the halacha. Because here we have, according to Soloveitchik, 2 direct consequences of natural immanence, right? Right? With respect to the halacha. Now, I want to go on to a second interesting point that Rabbi Soloveitchik makes. In this chapter, of man as an organic being, Rabbi Soloveitchik, speaking of man as a plant, speaks, elaborates very, very much on the halachas of Zeroyim. We see there's an entire section of the Mishnayos, of Shas, in which Chazal, in fact, go on in quite a detail, right, speaking about the halachas of plans. And these halachas of plans involve, in fact, very detailed observations as to the structure of plants and also to the classification of different types of flora and fauna. Now, Rabbi Soloveitchik understands the halacha in a very, very interesting way. On page 19, he writes, halacha's approach to the world, to the outside, that means to the world, is an objective mechanistic one. No mythical qualities, no supernatural traits, no animistic dreams. Okay? Dead and living matter surrounds us, and this matter must be interpreted in unison with a set of logical principles. Okay? The halacha looks for stability and lawfulness in this world. And then he goes on to say, the halacha studied the plant on three levels, the structural, the physiological, the technical. On all those levels, it observed, described, and explained the plant with full understanding of its peculiarity, primordial demands, inner insistences, and outer interrelationships. In Zeroyim, as in all regions of halachic cognitive activity, scientific knowledge of the realia contributes a great deal to the formulation of halacha formula and ideas. In some cases, it may change our whole halachic outlook. A trained botanist and agronomist may expose new halachic aspects in the realm of Zeroyim, Shabbos, and so on. Very interesting. Rabbi Soloveitchik understands that the halacha of Chazal, when describing nature, of course, in the halachas of Zeroyim, we speak about kiloyim, which is mixing different types of seeds, Rabbi Soloveitchik understands as being scientific. In other words, Chazal, when they speak about the physical world, are being scientific. Right? It doesn't mean they have the same scientific method, which came about after the time of the of Bacon, but nonetheless, the fact is, their observations are in fact scientific. So sort of Vaishik categorizes the halacha as being scientific. So we see is that much of the halacha of Chazal is really what we call Chazal science. And Rabbi Soloveitchik understands that this is to be called scientific in the full sense of the word. Yeah.
Is it halachic formulation or halachic application?
I think both formulation and application. He says at the end, a trained botanist and agronomist may expose new halachic aspects in the realms of Zeroyim and Shabbos.
That would be the application, meaning.
Well, yeah, but he speaks about the halacha as being interested in the stability and lawfulness of the world. You know, he's using halacha and scientific in contradiction to the mythical.
How does it relate to halachic man's concept of halacha, whereas it's an ideal concept?
That's a good question. Well, that's a theory of transcendence. This is, in fact, actually a theory of immanence. However, one could, in due respect, we can understand that just like in science too, a scientist might make a theory of a model, which is transcendence, and then apply it and measure it in real life, right? So too, in a halachic man too. First he speaks about the IPR relationship, and after that he speaks about going through all the measuring things, as we speak about the Tzitna Baal Tanya. So just refer to two, you know, parts of the scientific process. So but it doesn't remain a priori.
So the science would have a role in formulating the halachic ideal?
Right. Not only that, I think actually saying it's the same thing. Hainu hach. It is. Now, what's interesting is to contrast this with actually the thoughts of another great halachic giant of the 20th century, and also a philosopher of the halacha, Lenin the Chazanish. If you look in the Chazanish in Kiloyim, you'll see that the Chazanish understands the halachic process as not being scientific. In fact, the Chazanish understands the halachic process as being what I would say prophetic. In other words, somehow man's description of the world is not objective and scientific, but more or less prophetic in terms of man's inner relationship or somehow intuitive understanding of the world. And this distinction or this contrast between Rabbi Soloveitchik's approach. And the Chazanish's approach, you should know, is not only actually in the area of Zeroyim and the Halacha, but a general issue. The Chazanish understood actually the Halacha process to be in a certain sense a prophetic process, more than an objective process. But Oid Chazan Lemoyed, maybe one time we'll speak about the contrast between Rabbi Soloveitchik's understanding of the Halacha as being a very logical and exact, right, science, as opposed to the Chazanish's understanding of Halacha as the fact being very, very prophetic. Now, that's the second idea that comes out of this chapter, in which Rabbi Soloveitchik is discussing man as a plant. Now, there's actually an interesting, a third idea that actually is brought out in this chapter. It's interesting, we spoke about that there's an aspect of man as a plant. And, in other words, we can understand this, literally, is that since man begins as a plant, in the Sheshesh Megillah, right? Then in fact, actually, this plant aspect of man remains, in his beginning and in his end. And because of this, it represents a real part of the world, a real aspect of man. And therefore, the halacha has to address it when man is ostensibly in this vegetative or plant-like stage, namely, either at the beginning of life, as we spoke about in the fetus, the end of life, as a goyses. But the fact is that we see over here that the anthropology of man requires us to understand man in the context of his most natural and most, you call, antecedent, right, state of affairs. In other words, we're looking at man's history, quote-unquote primitive, most primitive history, as actually not being something which we would call primitive in a negative way, but rather, in fact, we're looking at primitivity, what we call primitivity, as being, in fact, actually an ideal and a natural function of man. Now, this concept actually comes across in a very, very long footnote. The footnote, Rabbi Soloveitchik speaks about man as being close to his environment, as is a plant, unity with the outside world, right? And he notes at the very top of page 17, other viewpoints on the contrary will strive to grant man more freedom and self-sufficiency. But in fact, actually, man is rooted very, very much within his environment, right? So in a footnote, Rabbi Soloveitchik says, certain philosophies are bent on freeing man from his confinement to a fixed environment. European intellectualism and rationalism and scientific technologism pursued as a prime objective. Primitive man was more tied with his natural surroundings than the modern Homo sapiens. Imagining man brute, we see him enmeshed with a certain environment, be it the jungle, be it in the cave. In fact, I think, I don't know if I quoted it last time, but in fact, actually, Rabbi Soloveitchik says actually explicitly later on in the book, he speaks about Adam HaRishon swinging in the trees like an ape. In other words, so he goes on and says over here, right? Some philosophers proclaim the ideal of return to nature. Such a controversy finds echo in political philosophy. The idea of fatherland bespeaks the bond between a man and a fixed environment. Fatherland described not only by political attributes, but by natural topography. He says, urban intellectuals tried to reject this. But nonetheless, he says, with the return of certain philosophers to the aboriginal sensuous apprehension of reality, with the rehabilitation of the primitive immediacy of our native knowledge, the contact between man and the world outside becomes more intimate. Such a romantic upsurge of man towards primordiality and oneness with the world outside has effect upon political philosophy, and he puts in parentheses Bergson's Elan Vital intuition. In other words, Rabbi Soloveitchik understands that Judaism, right, in fact, at least Judaism, heralds returning man to his fixed, to his, let's call it more a priori anthropology, his earliest anthropology, where actually man is enmeshed with his environment, not only enmeshed within nature, but actually enmeshed within a land, within a people. And this is very interesting. And why is this interesting? Because most people, if you ask most people what in fact actually is Judaism, they'll answer you and say that Judaism is a religion. But actually, the notion of Judaism religion is actually a relatively recent development. In fact, a development that fairly first began around the right around the beginning of the 19th century. Some scholars attribute actually Judaism's religion as actually originating in Moshe Mendelssohn. When Mendelssohn was forced to argue for Jewish rights, right? So, therefore, he had to argue for religious rights. Now, religious rights assumes that you have a religion, among other religions. So, therefore, in other words, to the Christians, Mendelssohn had to say that Judaism has every right to be called a religion, just as Christianity. Ipso facto, Judaism is a religion. Now, even though there are those who argue to Mendelssohn, namely Shishrafal Hirsch, if you actually read carefully into Hirsch's arguments, he is moide b'mikzas. He does accept, to a certain extent, that Judaism is a religion, but not only a religion. But, in fact, Kant himself always claimed, and I want to claim rightly true, that, in fact, Judaism is not a religion. It's a people with a law. So, in other words, what Rabbi Soloveitchik is saying is that the concept of Judaism as a religion is something which is actually a recent development. He calls it European intellectuals, but really a recent development of the 19th century. Before that, it's not clear at all that Judaism is a religion.
What does Rabbi Jewish mean by religion?
Religion means what makes a person a Jew is a theology. It's a religious philosophy. But, in other words, Christianity is called a religion. A person doesn't have to be born a Christian. A person becomes a Christian, and he has to believe in Christianity. A person becomes a Buddhist because he believes in Buddhism. But if a non-Jew believes in Judaism, as most people think, well, I believe in Judaism, and therefore I'm a Jew. That's not true. A person has to be part of a people. By the way, Derech Agav, there's an interesting nafka minin halacha, because in Gaelus, I mean, this is going to be a little bit controversial, but I'll say it anyway. In Gaelus, we don't see Kabbalah HaMitzvahs being a factor in Gaelus until the 19th century with the Beis Yitzchak, the Chandash Shlema, and Rav Chaim Isaac Ozhinsky. If you look at the Rishayna, but I'm even referring to the Tosfos too, as the Tshuva's Beis Meir says explicitly, Kabbalah HaMitzvahs is not a factor at all in Gaelus. What we have in Gaelus is Hoidas HaMitzvahs. We inform the Gaelus of some of the Mitzvahs, Mitzvahs Chomuas, Mitzvahs Kulois, to make sure that the Gaelus is Lishma. But Kabbalah is a mitzvah. I mean, explicitly the Ritva says it's not ma'akev several times in Shas. Kabbalah is what's called Kabbalah is a mitzvah, I think, is really something which develops in the poiskim in the 19th century. When Rav Chaim Isaac Ozhinsky writes in the tshuva, Kabbalah is a ma'akev, he puts in practice chemda shloime. Rav Chaim Isaac Ozhinsky knew what he was speaking about, as opposed to most other people. Namely, is that Kabbalah is a mitzvah becomes a factor in halacha when the world changes. And I'm not, chas v'shalom, actually making a critique. On the contrary, the concept of a secular Jew only arrived in the 19th century. So in other words, the halachic response of the Gedalia Poiskim was that it's not enough to be, you can't be a secular Jew in Gaelus. You have to be a religious Jew. Before that, all Jews were religious. If you don't want to be religious, you become a Christian. So in other words, what Rav Soloveitchik is saying here in this footnote, number 11, on page 17, which in my opinion is probably one of the most important footnotes in the book, is that the concept of Judaism as a religion is in fact actually a recent concept. And this is the Ramban, which he speaks about in the lectures of Genesis. According to the Ramban, not only did the Avis only keep the mitzvahs in Eretz Israel, but the Ramban, in fact, explains the Sefri that when you go to Goetz, you go to Chutz La'aretz, the exile, then you should keep the mitzvahs, shouldn't forget to remember to keep the mitzvahs. When you go back to Eretz Yisrael, the Ramban says the ikkah of the mitzvahs is in Eretz Yisrael, because we're going back to the called the Malas HaAvos, to the stage of the forefathers. According to the Ramban, even the mitzvahs, which are mitzvahs leguf, which Chazal tell us a person is required to do both in Eretz Yisrael and both in the Chutz La'aretz, both in the exile, but really the ikkah mitzvahs are done in Eretz Yisrael, because a Jew, right, in a sense, is part of a people and part of a land. He's indigenous to a people and to a land. So Rabbi Soloveitchik's point of a year is very, very much in an expression of his understanding of Judaism as being expressed in the Chumash. I mean, if it's the first invention of the 19th century, of course it's expressed in the Chumash and in Chazal, that Judaism is indigenous to a people and to a land. This is a philosophy of immanence. So even on the political level, right, Judaism espouses what's called biological affinity, and that a person very much has to be cognizant of this, because this is really the sheet of the Torah. Yeah.
Why immanence rather than just describing as like naturalism or being?
Naturalism. I'm using the naturalism in the same sense. In other words, immanence means I'm immanent within a natural setting. That's what I mean. But here I'm part of an environment. So this is in fact actually a very, very important idea that comes out from all of this, that in fact actually Judaism, by being a people, I mean we still are a people, and by being part of a land, that in fact Judaism is expressing man's connectedness, his natural biological connectedness with a people, a group, as we spoke about in Bergson, he quotes Bergson, and with a land, and of course the halachic connectedness too of with nature, of which plant life is actually one stage. Actually, that's how man begins life and man ends life. It's very interesting to note that there's also a very famous Jewish thinker of the 20th century who expresses very, very similar ideas, right, using different terminology, and that's actually Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kuk, that's all. If a person actually will study, maybe mitzvahshemashkafa.com, we will get to the philosophy of Rav Kook, especially the philosophy that emerges from his notebooks, which is published a few years ago in the Shemona Kavotzim, especially the notebooks, his notebooks from Yafo, right? I think from the 20s. It's clear that Rav Kook also expresses very Bergsonian concepts and understandings of the of Judaism, and even more so relates this to the concept of a people. It's a type of what you would call a halachic concept of Zionism, namely that just like the natural setting of the Jewish person is in his country in Eretz Yisrael and living among other Jews. So this point over here of Rabbi Soloveitchik is in fact very, very, very much fundamental is understanding of a, of the ontology of what is Judaism and who a Jew is. Now, like I said before, Rabbi Soloveitchik is actually just beginning. This is the first stage in actually what you would call, I don't call it the ascent of man, but in fact, actually, the describing man in the stages, which are, in fact, not only described in the Chumash and Maaseh Bereishis, but, in fact, actually, in later Parshas of the Torah, namely, Parshas Noach, and when Klai Yisrael in Vayikra, there in the Devarim, where Soloveitchik understands that the Chumash actually presents to us a history of man's, the history of man's anthropology, beginning from actually from Adam Harishon, towards before the Marble, before the Flood, after the Flood, and that's something that the Mitzvah Shem we're going to begin speaking about next week. In any case, from an undisclosed place in Yerushalayim HaKadosh, until next week, Kol Tuv and be well.